listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I talked to Letitia Gordon-Furze, a podcaster and mother of one, or potentially two by the time this goes out, who had a really tough lactation and pumping journey after her first son spent 5 weeks in NICU. She shares her own experience of relentless pumping and of the guilt and grief that contributed to postnatal depression. And we talk about the unhelpful and sometimes incorrect narratives that surround lactation and feeding. When you were pregnant with your first son, were you planning on breastfeeding, or what were your expectations back then?
Yeah, I absolutely was. So to be perfectly honest, I was a complete naturopath from my head to my toes. I'd had the whole thing planned out from the very beginning. And my granny, who is still alive, she's 93, she's in perfect health, is the biggest naturopath I know. She was organic before it was cool, had five babies at home, and was very much into natural birth, breastfeeding. And I love her to bits. I know she's, you know, she has her own views, but I was like, I know that I had her in the back of my mind. And I just thought, and as soon as I told her that I was doing NCT, she was over the moon and was like, yes, they're such a good organization. She was backing it in a way that I never really heard her kind of back stuff before. And I'm a massive nerd. Like, when I feel out of control of something, I like to study, because that's what makes me feel in control. So I just thought, I'll just read all the books. And if I've read all the books, then I can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Because
it's obviously that straightforward.
Wrong, right? Yes. So I just thought, I'll just read all the books. And so I did, and I had my breastfeeding book, and I'd already thought about nose to nipple position and all this stuff. And then it just started to go kind of progressively off key, which I guess is kind of what happens with children full stop, which is that you make these plans and then the plans sort of don't happen.
Yeah.
And I guess that no better place to start than birth, right? So my son was breech, and very stubbornly breech from the beginning. So he was just not moving. And I'd had midwives say, oh, he's still got time to turn. And I remember thinking, no, I just kind of know that this isn't happening. Mm. And I was offered an ECV, which is where they basically manually push the baby.
Yeah.
And I was really nervous about it. And because I just thought, my stomach feels really tight and I don't want to hurt the baby. And where does the cord go? And I was just really concerned about it.
Because they can be quite full on, can't they? Like, I haven't had one, but I've heard about
it. Yeah. So I didn't, and this is something that you and I were talking about before we started recording. They sort of seem to get around this by just basically not telling you anything. So they said, well, we'll do a manual, at ECV, it's external cephalic version. We'll do an ECV. And if it's uncomfortable at any time, we'll stop. And I said, okay, well, does uncomfortable mean painful, or what does that mean? And when they said, oh, we'll give you gas and air, I thought, oh, isn't that what you give people in labor? So this sounds like it's going to be really painful.
Yeah.
And I just thought, actually, this isn't for me. And it came with a lot of other conversations around natural breech birth, or I don't like saying natural birth, vaginal breech birth. And my mum had three vaginal births, second of which was my sister, who was breech. Mm. And I spoke to her and said, look, what was your experience and how did you find it? Expecting her to say, because she had unmedicated, so she had gas in her and that was it. And I was expecting her to say, you know, I had three babies. One of them was breech, was absolutely fine. And my mum just said, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. It was the worst experience I've ever had.
Right.
Had PTSD, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And a few things, conversations like that I had, and I just thought, okay, this isn't quite for me.
Mm.
So that sort of started the sort of deviation from my
from
perfect
the plan.
Path that
yeah.
I had, from the plan that I had laid out for myself. And I decided to have an elective C-section. Mm. And I'm really ashamed to say, because I don't know why, because society, because all sorts of things. I had thought, you know, people who were choosing C-sections and choosing bottle feeding, etc. I just thought, this is just totally ridiculous. Mm. You know, we're designed to do this, you know, for goodness sake.
Mm.
I just thought it was completely unnecessary. And then suddenly I was one of those people and I was like, oh, this is awkward. And so ended up, it's a long story, but at about 37 weeks, I started feeling fewer movements. And I thought, this is strange. And I sort of spoke to people about it and they said, well, the baby's running out of space to move, and things now that I know are myths, like so for example, hiccups in the womb, that's actually an involuntary reflex. It doesn't count as a movement. So I hadn't really felt the baby move. I think I just snaffled a whole bag of mini eggs and like drank a load of juice or something to try and get him moving, and then I felt these hiccups and I thought, oh, it's fine. So I did what you absolutely should not do, and I just went to bed. And about 5 o'clock the next morning, my stomach was just like a beach ball. So I was poking it, just nothing was happening. And I just thought, oh, this is really making me feel weird. And my hospital, I'm not kidding, had had an outbreak of bed bugs. So
oh God.
They were doing C-sections later than they normally would. So I wasn't booked for another 3 weeks. And went into hospital, didn't even take a hospital bag. I was literally expecting them just to send me home. And basically the baby was just in massive distress, and I ended up having an emergency Caesar that day. And I had a really good experience, even though it was an emergency Caesar, very calm, great people in the room. I felt very looked after, and baby came out and appeared to be fine. Appeared to be absolutely fine. So they do the Apgar scores of how alert your baby is, and it seemed to be fine. And then my husband kept pointing out later, he was like, why is his leg shaking? And midwives were saying, oh, it's fine, it's neurological, it's just, you know, it's because the nerve system's a bit immature. You know, it'll be fine. It just kept happening. So eventually they took the baby's blood sugar, and it was like unreadably low, and for babies that's super, super dangerous. So can lead to brain damage, can lead to coma. It's very, very serious if the baby has very low blood sugar. So off he was whisked to the NICU. And from my birth books that I had been reading, it had said, oh, you know, babies often spend time in the NICU, so don't worry about it. And we were there for 5 weeks. So there for a long, long, long time. So all the kind of breastfeeding stuff that I'd had in my head and everything was just, it was just out the window. And namely because we couldn't even get him on to breast milk because of his condition. So what had actually happened, and the reason why I'd needed an emergency Caesar, was that I had preeclampsia, but I didn't know it.
Oh.
And preeclampsia can cause your blood pressure to go very, very high.
Yeah.
And I'd had low blood pressure throughout the pregnancy, and I'm very low risk. So black women, people with diabetes, people who like have weight issues, they are much, much more likely to get it. And I had thought, oh, well, I don't tick any of those boxes, again, being smug and uninformed. And I thought, I'll be fine. I didn't even think about it. So actually, when at one of my midwife appointments, I'd taken part in a study, and I'd basically had a hormone that they'd been measuring. They said, you're actually really likely to contract preeclampsia. And I thought, I don't think so. And I'd completely forgotten about it until I was then in hospital with reduced movements. And I said, oh, by the way, they actually said I was really likely to get preeclampsia. And then they suddenly went, oh, and sort of started to freak out. And preeclampsia, in very, very rare cases, so I think it's 1 in 40 or 50,000, can produce what it produced in my son, which is something called hyperinsulinism, which is like the opposite of diabetes. So rather than your child not producing enough insulin, it produces too much. So it would be like you eating a chocolate bar, but your body thinks you've eaten five. So it like over breaks down all the sugar, and then you end up with really low blood sugar. So it's then this balance of trying to basically drug the baby. And again, not in the concept of my natural birth, drug the baby to get their pancreas to kind of chill out and stop producing so much insulin, so that every time you're giving the baby any sort of sugar, whether it's breast milk or just pure glucose, which is what he was on, just to keep his blood sugar at a normal level, that he can deal with it and maintain a steady blood sugar. But it meant that he was on a fluid restriction. And obviously, if you put a baby on your boob, you can't measure what's going in and out.
Yeah.
by the milliliter. You can't do it. And it was really to the milliliter. So we were increasing it day by day by 1 milliliter, his breast milk intake, and then seeing what would happen to his blood sugar. And it would go wild. It would go like through the roof and then right down to the ground. And then they'd have to just give him intravenous glucose. And it was just crazy. And I threw myself into pumping. And that is kind of the beginning of my breastfeeding journey. So I've just whittled on at you for ages, but that was the beginning of it.
Yeah. You've told me earlier that that was really, really tough. Like, you were pumping nonstop for 6 weeks. It was really, really painful. You were sobbing, crying. What happened? What was it like? So you started pumping because you couldn't put him on the breast.
So I started pumping exactly because I couldn't put him on the breast. And to me, it was just so obvious. And I guess also as well, there's a huge amount of just instinct to it, which is you think, well, my baby's in the NICU. And for me, it was the moment where they tried to discharge me. So obviously I'd had a C-section, so you stay in for a bit longer anyway. And I'd been there for about 3 days. And this woman who came in, and I think she just didn't know the story, and I think she didn't really know what was coming on. She was like, well, you're being discharged today. And I was like, I can't leave my child. Like, I can't leave the hospital. And that was a huge, unbelievably upsetting moment. And I think so much pressure on the NHS, and, you know, midwives have got other stuff on their plate, but it was just unfortunate that the way that she delivered the news was just not madly sensitive to what we were going through. My husband was really bothered and sort of went back out to speak to her and just was like, my wife's like in pieces. Like, you know, is there any way we can stay long? And of course you can't, they need the beds. You know, it was really tough. But I'd bought breast pumps anyway, because I'd been to one of those hilarious, but actually they're very good, baby fairs, which was like this huge exhibition at the XL Centre in London. And again, at the time I thought, this is really unnecessary. I don't need these like hands-free, amazing pumps. But actually it ended up being a game changer because I was in the NICU, because when your child's in a box, in a Perspex box, the lactation process is really sensitive. So oxytocin, which is that huge rush of hormones we get when we give birth, etc., that all facilitates breastfeeding because it facilitates your letdown reflex. And adrenaline directly inhibits oxytocin, so it inhibits your letdown reflex. So if you're feeling very stressed, it's the letdown doesn't happen. Basically, you just need to try and be as close to your baby as possible. So often they advise you, oh, look at pictures of your baby, look at videos, like as you pump, just to try and feel vaguely happy, I guess, when you're like trying to suck everything out of your boobs. And they had a little, what I called the dairy, which was like a milking room in the NICU, that just was like the most uncomfortable chairs you've ever sat on in your life. With pumps next to them, so just pumps all the way along the wall, and you're sitting directly opposite other women who are doing the same, so you're all there with your boobs out, just like you are a cow. I don't know how else to describe it. And I'd never had a baby before. I'm quite a prude person. Like, I'm not the type to like get my boobs out willy-nilly. So it was suddenly like in this very weird situation where I was having to just kind of flash people on a regular basis, because that's kind of what breastfeeding is in lots of circumstances. But by the way, I keep saying breastfeeding. I actually am referring to, obviously, to lactating rather than breastfeeding, because it's slightly different, and I want to make that distinction for a few reasons. But Every time I was putting the hospital pumps on, which were like industrial grade, scary strength kind of hospital pumps that were really going to suck whatever it was out of your boob. And I was sitting opposite all these other women, and nobody would talk, and you would just sit there on your phone. Everybody was upset because everybody's baby was unwell. And it was just a very surreal environment to be beginning my breastfeeding journey. And I wasn't allowed to put him onto the boob because of these fluid restrictions. So it was like the only way that I could breastfeed my baby was to pump just solidly. And to be perfectly honest, the idea of formula hadn't even entered my brain, because I just thought, I have to give him, he's so unwell, and I just have to give him as much like goodness as I like possibly can. So I will pump until it kills me. And then it kind of did. So I don't know. I mean, the people who are listening who have newborns, your child feeds however many times a day in the beginning, I wouldn't know because I've never done it. But they advise with pumping, because you can't regulate your supply in the same way, because it's not like a symbiotic relationship with your baby where they feed and then your boob produces the right amount. You're just kind of pumping and guessing pretty much from the beginning. And so I was pumping 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times a day to get liquid out of my boobs. And then we were just freezing it. So it was labeling it, timing it, everything, and then putting it in the freezer, putting it all, arranging it all by date, etc. And you had to be very sterile and very careful because obviously you're in the NICU and your baby's unwell. So just from a sheer like logistical point of view, it was just really complicated. And every time you pump, you're having to wash, sterilize everything. And as much as the LV pumps were brilliant, there's lots and lots of tiny, fiddly little parts. Yes. And because you're pumping so frequently, they're not dry by the time you're doing the next pump. So then you're using like tissue, which is definitely not sterile, to try and dry the pump parts. And sometimes because they weren't fully dry, the suction wouldn't be working. So I would be sitting there with a pump on my boob for 40 minutes and then I'd look down and there'd be like 10 mil. It'd be like, the, you know, 3 millimeters high worth of milk in there. And I'd be like, oh my God, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just frustration. But then it was just the pain that started to get really, really bad. And I think there was so much uncertainty about my son. They didn't know whether it was a genetic condition that would require like a Great Ormond Street Hospital transfer, or whether it was something that was just caused by the preeclampsia and it was, they call it transient, which just means temporary. And as it turns out, it was transient in the end, but it was, they just called it persistent. And so they had to monitor him really closely. And it meant that I managed two occasions where I could put him on the boob.
Okay.
And it was the most incredible feeling experience. It was absolutely amazing. And I felt like a mum doing that. And I hadn't felt like a mum at any other time. Like pumping didn't make, you know, watching Game of Thrones in the middle of the night, eating chocolate with just two machines on my boobs whilst I just like cried, it just didn't feel like, you know, a mum experience at all. We had the car seat, everything was all still in the house, all his baby clothes, and just the loneliness and the emptiness of the experience was just, I can't even describe. And the pain started pretty close to the beginning, I think, because I was so stressed by the situation. And
of course, yeah.
Anyone who's had a kid in the NICU, you have to be there at a particular time for ward rounds every morning, because that's when you get the best and most comprehensive update about your child. So, and it could be any time between 8 and about 1 p.m. So 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. And you just had to wait. You just had to wait and sort of hope for the best and be around. So there's a phenomenal amount of just waiting to get this update about your child. Sometimes you'd miss it because you'd be out getting a coffee or trying to get something to eat. And we were spending 10, 11, 12 hours per day in the hospital every day, 7 days a week. And I don't know when exactly it started, but I know that lactating and breastfeeding in general is painful at the beginning. So I don't know whether my experience would have been different. You know, I know that cracked nipples are still a problem. You know, if you breastfeed, I know that mastitis, etc., is still a problem. But it started to get to a point where I was just in agony, and I was recovering from a C-section, and the pain of lactating was worse. But I mean, like 10 times worse than the C-section. And I was like, I was so embroiled in the situation. I wasn't even aware enough to be like, this isn't normal, or this isn't right. Or I was just so focused on, I have to pump. That's the only thing I can control. I have to just keep pumping and give him as much breast milk as I possibly can. And nobody really challenged me on it either, because in the NICU, the focus is suddenly all on your child rather than you as the woman. And actually, I think that that experience transcends everybody's birth experience, which is why birth can be such a groundbreaking point for so many women, because antenatally, they can't leave you alone.
Yeah.
They're all over you all the time. And then the minute you have the baby, they're like, oh, you don't exist anymore. You have your 6-week check and then it's all baby, 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 baby. Mm. You're lucky if they check you anyway for your stitches or whatever. And then it's like, okay, sign, you know, see ya. Mm. Like, whatever. It's all about your child now. It's nothing about you. And of course it should be to a big degree about your child, but so much of the happiness of a baby and the comfort and physical well-being of the baby is to do with the physical well-being of the mother as
well.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And it was like a sort of, it was like a little microcosm of that. So, and even my birth debrief, the fact that the teams don't even talk to each other. So the obstetrics team do not speak to the NICU team at all. Like they don't even know who the other consultants are. And often it was me who was being, and my husband, who was being the intermediary between them, because we were the only people with all the information, because they kind of thought, oh, well, they're sort of irrelevant. You know, oh, we think because it was because of preeclampsia, but you'll have to speak to them. You know, they weren't interested in that necessarily. They were just focused on getting the baby healthy, which, of course, again, they should be. But there was no middle point person being like, what is this whole experience doing to this particular family?
Yeah.
And that's a structural issue, which we could go into lots, but I won't for the purpose of time. But yeah, so it just meant that I was going through all this pain, but just to describe the pain, it was like having broken glass running through my boobs every single time I put the pumps on. And I felt like I had no choice in the situation, again, because I hadn't even thought about the alternative. I hadn't even considered it. And secondly, because I felt like that was the thing that I had to do. Mm. So, but I was, as I said to you before, and as you mentioned, I was like sobbing. So I'd put the pumps on and I'd start crying before they even got on to my boobs. It was so agonizingly painful. So I would just sit there for 40 minutes, just weeping, 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 weeping. And my supply just kept going further and further down.
Of course,
so
yeah.
And you'd see all these women, other women in the NICU. And obviously, every woman's glandular tissue and everything is different. People produce different amounts. People's hormones vary wildly. People's experiences vary wildly. So some people in the NICU were just there for a couple of days, or some people were there for months and months. But, you know, you'd sit opposite these women with the hospital pumps and they were filling up, you know, jar after jar after breast milk. And I'd be there with less than a centimetre from each boob coming out. And I remember just thinking, what's wrong with me? Like, I just need to spend longer. I just need to sit for longer on the pumps and then that will like fix it. That I got really, you get very fixated on the quantity. And again, through my research now, I know that it's not good to look at the amount that you're pumping. You just need to put the pumps on and just forget about it and just try and do something else. But because I'd routinely had this problem with wet bits in the pumps and suction and etc., and I was so fixated and controlling and paranoid about trying to get the right amount of milk. And I think I'm sure somebody would have said I had probably quite severe postnatal anxiety at that point. It was just, it was so bad. I just couldn't stop looking at the amount all the time and obsessing. And also you had to write to the milliliter on the special little pot exactly how much you've produced. So it was this self-perpetuating cycle of just sort of fixation on the amount, general stress of the situation, and then conditions that I had that I didn't realise I had. So breast thrush, if anyone's listening who's ever had this, absolutely agonisingly painful, and you don't necessarily know that you have it until you look at your child's tongue. And if you see like a white film that's not going away after your child's finished feeding, the chances are that it is breast thrush, but for anybody who's had it, it is phenomenally painful and very, very difficult to get rid of. So eventually I'd like managed to find a midwife somewhere, because again, there were no midwives because we were just in a NICU.
And there were no lactation consultants around that, no.
There was one amazing woman called Teresa, who doesn't work there anymore, who was actually just, she was something else. She had a completely different job title. And she had just been filling in all the gaps. So she said, I actually don't do anything to do with breastfeeding. But the I will help you. And NICU nurses kept saying to me, oh, just speak to Teresa, just speak to Teresa. And I was like, who is this woman? And then I thought, well, and she was hilarious. She was Hungarian, just really full on, like super no nonsense, just direct, straight to the point. And like, she used to, the two times where I actually did have my son on the boob, she was like, right. And as soon as he opens his mouth, like just jam him on the boob. And she was hilarious, but it worked. It did work. And but she wasn't even paid for that. You know, she wasn't, because the hospital, I don't know, they just hadn't, they just thought, well, the pumps are there. And that's what I had thought too, which is just like, your milk comes in, then you put a pump on, then milk comes out, then you feed your baby. Yeah. And I had thought of it in that linear, like, you know, obviously that, you know, breast is best and breast is so natural and it's the most natural thing in the world and it will come really easily to me.
What could possibly go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? And then, yeah, and then it was just, it was crazy. And the couple of times where I told you about that I did have my son on the boob, I'd been interrupted less than 5 minutes later with a really scary medical procedure that my son would need or something. And I just, the vulnerability of sitting there half naked, you know, trying to, in a tiny, you've got like a sort of token privacy screen around you and your child's incubator. And then four doctors just whip the whole thing back and say, right, we've got to do a blood test now, which is agony for the baby because their blood vessels are so deep because they're little chub-chub when they're that age. And again, the prospect of highly painful procedure coming up that I'm then going to have to watch, like none of this is helping my milk situation in general. And it got to the point where on one of the occasions I had a complete like breakdown and they had to move me into another room with my baby because I was like, I just need time. I haven't had any alone time with my child and it's been 4 weeks and I can't deal with this anymore. And it was so wrapped up in what my boobs were doing and the fact that they were just letting me down and I just couldn't produce enough. And in the end, again, benefit of hindsight and having spoken to lots of people about it since, I produced 6 weeks worth of milk. Like I did produce plenty and that was, but that's with, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 times pumping every single day, had a schedule for it and everything.
Yeah.
And it was the point where I was at home, I was feeling really, really unwell and we were supposed to go into the hospital just like every other day. We still had no idea when my son was going to be discharged. At this point, he was a month old and we'd been doing this, you know, 7 days a week. And pumping, you have to do it overnight as well. So we're getting all the sleepless nights with none of the newborn cuddles, etc. We had stacks of cards, flowers, stuff that I hadn't even opened because I felt like superstitiously, I was like, I don't want to open anything until he's home. I don't want to speak to anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody until he's home. So loads of people obviously get in touch and be like, congratulations. And I had NCT friends that were having babies and going home all throughout this time that we were still going in and out. And so I was pumping overnight. So getting all of the sleeplessness with none of the like positive side at the end of it. And woke up in the morning, was expecting to drive to hospital to just spend another day at the NICU, as always. And I was just like, I feel really unwell, like really, really, really unwell. And took my temperature and it was 42 degrees, which is about 106 or something. And I was like, I feel almost like I'm hallucinating. I just didn't feel right at all. And my mum, who had been staying with us the whole time, so she kept us all going and then she came in and looked at me and was like, you just don't look right. And my husband was so broken from doing all the washing, all the sterilizing, you know, at 10 p.m., 1 a.m., 4 a.m., 7 a.m., then driving me to hospital, then spending the whole day there, then doing it. I was literally pumping every 3 hours. He was exhausted as well from getting up and being so interrupted. And my mum was like, I think I actually need to take her to hospital. Like, this is really not good. And I just looked green. And ended up going. And in my head and from my breastfeeding book, it was Mastitis is not an infection. Mastitis is an inflammation. And it's all part of the medical establishment's conspiracy to tell you that mastitis is something serious. You shouldn't be taking antibiotics for mastitis. You should be using cold compresses, this, that, whatever. And I have no doubt that those things work when it is mild. I have no doubt at all. I'm sure. And they were like, you just need to clear your boob, clear your boob. And it was like, I felt like screaming and being like, what the F do you think I'm trying to do? I'm literally sitting with pumps on my boobs all day trying to clear my boobs. I can't do it. It's like, I can't do it. And came into the hospital, went to the postnatal ward, which was luckily just two floors down from the NICU, and saw this doctor. And doctors are pretty good at being, you know, clinical, obviously. And I've never seen somebody look at me with just genuine sort of pity, for want of a better word. She just looked at me like, this is really crap, this whole situation. She was really kind, and I appreciated her empathy so much in that moment because it had been a month of this. And whilst they were waiting to decide whether to admit me, or I don't know, I was just waiting for another doctor or another doctor's opinion, I was standing over a sink with my mum, as I've already said, kind of a Victorian personality, not very good at just getting my boobs out at every moment. And I was in so much pain that I was just standing over the sink trying to just milk myself again, because I didn't have the pumps with me. I didn't know how long I was going to be there for. I knew that I had to get the milk out to get myself better. And my mum was like there with me, like trying to help me push this like milk out of my boob. It just wasn't happening. And just the humiliation of that scene. I know that sounds weird, but I was so humiliated by just, I can't believe I'm in this position where like I can't stop crying. I feel like there's fluid leaking out of me in every orifice, but it's all the wrong places.
Yeah.
And just thinking, what the fuck am I, what, how am I in hospital? How is this even happening? I need to go and see my son, you know, but I'm here. I just need to get the breast milk out and then go. I need to not be here. Eventually they decided to admit me, and I was thinking, this isn't in the breastfeeding book. Like, that, you know, that
just take the cold compresses.
That you can hospitalize yourself with mastitis. I didn't even know that that was possible. And I was there for 3 days, and I was on, I think, 3 or 4 bags, I can't remember, of antibiotics just to get my temperature down. And again, in the meantime, I was Googling, and it said, you're just going to have to up the pumping. So if you have bad mastitis, you're just going to have to pump more to get your supply up. And I just, at this point, was like, I can't I don't know how this is possible. But again, I was like, but I'm going to do it and it will be fine. And obviously at this point, it was not fine. It was definitely not fine. And I think my mum was definitely in the camp of, I think she needs to stop. This isn't working. But thankfully, our son eventually got discharged at 5 weeks. And whilst I was just waiting to be discharged myself, because that's when the mastitis happened, it was right at the end of the hospital stay. This midwife came in and spoke to me and said, like, why, by the way, like, why are you pumping all the time? And I explained the situation. And she was just like, you've done really well. You've done really, really well to keep pumping for this long. And you can just switch to formula if you think it would be, you know. She didn't even pose the question back to me. She just said, I think that would be a better option for you at this point. And it was like my world had imploded, and I just thought, I can't, because formula is poison. And I had, honestly, that was really in my head, that I was like, I've already let down my son in so many ways. He's so ill. He's on so many different types of drugs. I can't give him formula as well, because then I might as well not exist as a mum. And I couldn't feel, I felt like I would just be redundant as a mother if I couldn't breastfeed my child somehow. So I sort of ingested what she said and sort of thought, well, that's the first person that said that to me, and even said it as a vague suggestion. I hadn't even thought about it, Googled it, nothing. Didn't have any bottles at home, because I thought, why would I need bottles? Didn't have formula machine, didn't have any of this stuff. when we got him home, he had a very militant drug schedule. We actually had to get on Excel to do a spreadsheet to do like times of day, make special boxes to tick things off, etc. And I said, well, I'm going to have to up the pumping schedule to 12 times a day. So I said to my husband, can you factor all my pumping times in as well? So he just kind of was like, right, okay. So he put all the pumping schedules in as well. And it was just this sort of mad, horrible spreadsheet. He and my mum, I didn't know at the time, had sort of conspired together and said, let's just let Betty look at the spreadsheet and then she can make her own decision. Mm. Because when she sees it, she'll know that this is insanity. Mm. Because she would just spend every waking minute pumping or drugging her child and that there will be nothing in between. And my husband's pat leave had ended at this point. Yeah. So he was about to go back to work. We'd only just got our baby home and I was still recovering from the mastitis and the C-section and. So it's kind of a full-on time. So I looked at the spreadsheet and I remember just looking at it on the fridge and being like, I think this isn't going to work, actually. And it was this amazing combination of feelings of huge relief, massive relief that I wasn't going to have to pump anymore, and then massive, massive, massive guilt. And I couldn't reconcile those two feelings, and it turns out I couldn't reconcile them for a very, very long time. It was an experience.
And you were diagnosed with postnatal depression, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but it took a while to get that diagnosis. So we had him at home, and because of his condition, we had to measure his blood sugar 8 times a day, right at the beginning. And that involves pricking the heel of your baby until they bleed and the baby screams. It's really unpleasant. And we still had him on an exact quantity of milk. So he was only allowed 57 millilitres every 4 hours or whatever, which is just not the way that you expect to bring your baby home and feed your baby. But it also meant that as he was growing, he needed more, obviously. But we weren't allowed to feed him more unless we drove to the hospital and weighed him on their scales. So we couldn't weigh him at home. We had to drive to the hospital. And it's like a 25-minute drive away across London. And the stress of, and again, the impotence that you feel as a parent, your child's screaming, and you can't, for their health, you can't give them more fluid than they're allowed. It was hell on earth. I wouldn't wish this entire experience on my worst enemy. It was absolutely hell. But also another great reason why I wouldn't have even been able to put him on the boob when I got home. It was still just going to have to continue this pumping journey until he was cured. And at that point, it was looking, they were saying 18 months. So it was never really going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what I found very difficult about the bottle feeding, once I got over the initial kind of, okay, right, this is how it is, was that lots of very well-meaning people, family members, etc., then wanted to kind of get in on the feeding and was like, I feed the baby? Can I feed the baby? And I wasn't self-aware enough at the time, I think because I was in the throes of P&D and hadn't really realised it, how much that was upsetting me, because I'd already felt redundant as a mum because I thought, well, if I can't even feed my own child and I can't be there for them and I can't give them perfect health and I can't give them all these miracle antibodies, et cetera, then I might as well not exist. There are all these other people who seem to be able to comfort the baby better than me. They know what to do better than me. They know how to burp him better than me. I don't know what I'm doing. And all these other people know what they're doing. And I just thought, well, I might as well not exist. And I think that feeling just got bigger and bigger until I just thought, I hate this so much. I just don't want to be here anymore. And that's, it was really bad. And it took a while, again, for me to kind of figure out that it wasn't normal to feel. I'm always really hesitant to say the word suicidal, but I felt like it would be easier. It's making me sad now. I felt like it would be easier if I, like, wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
So it was then just trying to access the right care that was available. and actually, although it was lots of like going around the houses to find that care, I did actually access it quite quickly. And then it was amazing from there. So I had a woman, a perinatal team, whatever that means. I still don't really know what that means. But this woman came to my house every week and observed me with the baby, observed how I was feeling. I didn't need to go on any medication. And again, I guess my grandmother's hangover didn't want any medication. I thought I need to just do this by myself. We pinpointed that it was the feeding that was just really bugging me. And again, because of a lot of the rhetoric that's out there about breastfeeding, I thought, I can't bond with my child unless I'm breastfeeding, because that's what everything says, which is that you bond with your child when you're breastfeeding. And I can't do that, so I can't bond with him. Yeah. When actually that's bullshit. Mm. It's complete bullshit. And I basically realised, slightly by myself and slightly with the input of this amazing team that were around me. So it was this perinatal nurse, and then I had a community nurse who was just like a, they called her a nursery nurse, but I still don't really understand what she did. She would just come and observe me with the baby. Mm. She taught me baby massage, like ways that I can, and pointed out ways that he was interacting with me that I didn't really realise because I was just in this deep pit. Yeah. And was like, oh, look, he's looking at you, or he's smiling, or, mm-hmm. you know, do you see how he makes this noise when he does this? He obviously is, you know, he's trying to connect with you. And that really helped, like, just build that bond between him and me. Mm. And she also came once a week. So this is, like, pretty impressive intervention from the NHS. It just took forever to get it. It was just one of those things.
Yeah.
They basically said, every time I wanted to feed my son, I just needed to just take him off and just go by myself and reclaim control over that process. So I stopped saying to people, you can have it, or just being passive. I used to not even say anything. People would just take him off me and then go and feed him. And it got to the point where I was like, by the way, and I remember saying to my husband, can you tell X person, whoever it was, that it's only me feeding the baby now? Mm. And that can seem really strange on the outside if you're just coming to visit the baby and you think, oh, great, you know, I'm a family member, I can feed him or whatever. And I was like, no, I don't want that anymore. And I think it was difficult for people to understand that. Mm. But at that point, I recognised that for my own sanity and for the sake of the relationship of me and my son, I had to make that about me and him. So I did skin to skin, but I did it with a bottle. And I'd had quiet time doing all the feeds, but I did that with a bottle. Mm. And I guess the hormone flow, everything, that just was a complete game changer. Mm. And that just, I don't know, I don't even want to say like re-solidified, because it created the relationship between he and I that has obviously been the basis of it ever since. But looking back, it's just so sad that I thought that was breastfeeding. If I wasn't doing that, there was no other way that I could bond with my child. And when you look at breastfeeding pros and lists online or whatever, they say, oh, well, it's such a good bonding experience. It's so this, so that. And actually, they've done studies that say that you get similar levels of oxytocin or whatever when you're bottle feeding, because it's the act of feeding. It's not necessarily the physiological process, even though, of course, it does release oxytocin, they have also shown that it does with the bottle as well. And frankly, if you're in a postnatal depressive state, you need any amount of oxytocin is going to help you to feel better.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it did. And that's what eventually pulled me out of the PND. But it took months. It took a long time.
Mm. You've written a really fantastic piece about feeding, bottle feeding and breastfeeding, the various myths, tips, the industry surrounding both. I'm curious about your thoughts on, like, how can we talk about breastfeeding and try to promote it in areas where it isn't, you know, where the uptake is low and probably for the wrong reasons, I suppose there's not the right supports in place and everything, without this shame and this, as you're saying, promoting this idea that bottle is wrong and that you're letting your child down and you're not as good a mother if you're not breastfeeding. How can we talk about these things in a way that supports and helps everyone, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a few things there. So you talked about low uptake of breastfeeding, which is actually, I would argue, almost a separate topic to how do we talk about these things in a more open and honest way. And I think there are a few things going on. So with the low uptake of breastfeeding, there's all sorts of reasons for that that aren't yet, in my view, they aren't yet fully in the public domain. So, for example, using the USA, there are a lot of government initiatives that were, and actually that still exist, that actually withhold social security payments to women if they aren't breastfeeding. So they say, well, if you're bottle feeding, we'll only give you a certain amount of money, but if you're breastfeeding, we'll give you X. And it's a way to try and incentivize breastfeeding. But what they're not realizing is that breastfeeding... So people often say one of the pros of breastfeeding is that it's free. It's free. Formula is so expensive and breastfeeding is free. Breastfeeding is only free if we don't value a woman's time and energy. Mm. And if you're from a low socioeconomic background, the chances are you're working irregular shifts. You might not have proper mat leave benefits because you don't work for some plush company. In the UK, they only have to pay you for 6 weeks. And in the USA, they don't have to pay you at all. So they don't have to pay you anything. And you don't even have the right to keep your job. Whereas in the UK, at least, you can hold your job position for a year if it's not made redundant, which the whole organisation Pregnant Then Screwed, which is a UK-based organisation, looks at that. So it looks at all these stealth redundancies that mysteriously happen to women who are on maternity leave. So your job's not very stable. You're trying to go back to work as quickly as possible. Bottle feeding is a... great way to make that happen, because if you're breastfeeding, you're having to pump in a cupboard, as I've just described from my whole experience. Pumping doesn't exactly take 5 minutes. It takes a long time. It takes the same amount of time as a feed. So sometimes it's 20 minutes, sometimes it's 40 minutes, sometimes it's longer, depends on the day. So there are lots of factors that I don't think we have properly explored as a society as to why we don't have a good rate of breastfeeding when compared to the rest of Europe. But it is worth mentioning that France has a lower rate in breastfeeding than us as well. So there are other countries that also have this challenge. And I don't want to say it's a problem, because we also need to look at that as well. So what is it structurally in our society which means that lots of women aren't breastfeeding? It could be, and I would say most likely is, because we don't have the proper postnatal structure in place in our society in general. As I said, they can't get enough of you prenatally, antenatally. They're all over you. Probably, if you're a healthy person, you've probably never had so much interaction with your health system as you do when you're pregnant. I remember thinking, am I going in again? Like, having another appointment? You know, I'm used to... you know, them saying, oh, I'll come back in 2 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, why are they taking my blood pressure again? This is so weird, you know. And they just can't get enough of you. And then the contrast of that, you then have the baby, and 30 years ago, you'd stay in hospital for 7 days or maybe even longer. That is a long time. And if you have a vaginal birth these days with no tears, epidural, they'll get you out the same day.
Oh, even if you have a tear.
Even if you have a tear, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, and with a C-section, particularly in COVID, they're getting some people out within 24 hours. I mean, breastfeeding, people often say it's a learned skill. It's not necessarily something that is just natural.
Absolutely.
Complete myth. It's something you have to work on. And it's also very dependent on your own anatomy. So the shape of your nipples, the amount of glandular tissue you have in your breast, but also on the baby's anatomy. So the baby's tongue, do they have a tongue tie? The absolute classic that is often undiagnosed for such a long time. And also just the baby's general muscles. So I had this problem with my son where, because he hadn't been feeding, he was had very underdeveloped jaw and mouth muscles in general. It took a long time for him to build that up. So I gave him I was told to give him a dummy from the beginning, which then I got lots of judgment about because dummies. But it's one of those things where there are so many factors that affect whether we breastfeed or not. And it's not simply a case of you're not trying hard enough, or, I don't know, you're just uninformed or you're uneducated. And I think that's a lot of myths that are still floating around, which is just that if you're not breastfeeding, then there's clearly no reason why, and you're just stupid or you're selfish.
Yeah.
as a mother. Mm-hmm. People might not say it directly, but they'll say it in other ways. So I would explain my entire case history to my health visitor, and then she'd say, so you're not breastfeeding? And I'd say, no, I'm not. I've literally just explained this entire story.
Yeah.
And then she'd say, have you tried?
Oh,
and I'd say, I don't even know what to do. And I had that so many times. I had that at my 6-week check. I had that when you're going to get your baby weighed. Every single time I would be asked, like, you know, are you breast or bottle feeding? I don't see why they had to ask that every time. And then I would just get given these leaflets, and you're surrounded by posters everywhere in all the doctor's offices. Breast is best. Here's all the support to breastfeed. Here's this. When actually, psychologically, often people need quite a bit of support with bottle feeding as well. Mm. And because there was so little information out there about bottle feeding, I had to like text my friends, well, I don't even know how to make up a bottle. I have no idea. I don't know what equipment to buy. I don't know anything. So I think the low uptake of breastfeeding needs more analysis, I think, to give a proper reason as to why. Because I think it's emotional factors, it's social factors, it's structural factors insofar as we don't get enough support. Mm. But also, I mean, in that article that I've written, which is the nutshell. So the nutshell is something that I write once a month. I basically research the crap out of them. I academically reference everything that I write in a way to try and give you all the information in a judgment-free way that's easily accessible. Mm. And I was really shocked by the breastfeeding rhetoric that's out there and things that people say about breastfeeding that just aren't... that just aren't necessarily true, for want of a better description. So as an example, breastfeeding and SIDS risk, so cot death risk. Mm. And they say that breastfeeding protects against SIDS. That is an absolute myth. I want to just say that now. Mm. Breastfeeding does not protect against SIDS. All that they've done is that they've looked at two groups of people, one of whom breastfeed and one of whom do not. And then they've looked at the babies in the group and looked at how many SIDS incidences were in this group and how many were in this group. So how many were in the bottle-fed group, how many were in the breastfed group. The chances are that because breastfeeding takes so much time and energy, you probably have a pretty good mat leave package, which means you're probably pretty wealthy. You're probably from a pretty well-educated background as well. Maybe you've really persisted at the breastfeeding because, you know, you've read all the books and you really, really want to do this.
You can pay for private support.
You can pay for lactation consultants, the pumps, etc., which, by the way, are a minimum of £140 for a pump. This is not a cheap, and that's not even mentioning breastfeeding, breast milk storage bags, nipple cream, which is £10 a tube, all of these things that cost a lot of money, which if you're on minimum wage, you might not be spending. No. If breastfeeding's not coming easily to you, the money, and by the way, lactation consultants can be £250 an hour. This is not cheap stuff. So you're then dealing with that side of the expensive side of things. You've got these two parties with the big SIDS risk and then apparently no SIDS risk at all. But you're not taking into account all of the other factors in that group. And it's not a cause, it's a correlation. And it's a classic economics article, which makes for great headline news when you say, oh, breastfeeding protects against cot death. No, it doesn't. And when you actually dig into the data, and Emily Oster, who's a wonderful author on this point, she's an American economist who wrote a book called Expecting Better. Mm. She digs into this much better than I am right now. But she just looks at all these assumptions and, I don't know, just lines that are just fed out to people, which is, oh, your baby is more likely to be obese, or they're more likely to have diabetes, or they're more likely to die from SIDS, which is pretty... You can't get much stronger than that, can you? Like, if you breastfeed your child, they're less likely to die.
Yeah, exactly. So,
again, it doesn't help with the guilt. Mm. You know, if you're not able to, you then think, oh my God, I'm going to kill my child.
Do you want when to actually, kill your child? Do you want to, you know, are you still going to choose to bottle feed? Okay, now you've made an informed choice.
Exactly. Yeah. And they say, oh, don't worry, it's your choice, but, you know, SIDS risk.
But you're like, a murderer. Oh my God.
Yeah. But you're a murderer. And then you look at the data and you're like, actually, this isn't true. That's not true. And it's important it doesn't make the data irrelevant, but it makes it important that we question the source and look at what it's actually saying. Mm. Are they saying that breast milk protects against some mystery disease? that lots of babies are dying from. Okay, if so, then you could link the two, and it's what we call causative rather than correlative. Mm. But breastfeeding in particular, there are a lot of quite big health claims that are made that are very much correlative and not causative. And that's what I talk about in this article. And it's not to push people one way or another whatsoever. The article is designed for people who are struggling with breastfeeding, A, or B, people who just want more information, better information for them to make their own decision. Or C, it's just for people who are curious and just want to know more about the situation that's not in a judgmental frame, basically.
It's great, and I will link it in the show notes as well, because it's a really great resource. I know that we could talk about this all day, but I'm conscious of time, and I want to ask you as well, because you're pregnant again.
Yes.
How are you feeling about everything now, and where are you at on feeding?
That's a great question. I think, and it's a hard question, you know. I've been really feeling mixed about the whole situation. I think the whole experience has made me feel very conscious of how I'm going to feed the baby for the second time. Sometimes I've said to people, well, I don't have, what if the baby's healthy? Because then I don't have any excuse. Then I have to breastfeed because I won't have that reason. I won't be able to wave that at people and say, well, I couldn't breastfeed because X. Like, what if the breastfeeding's not working anyway? And for me, I haven't had that newborn experience because I didn't have a child at home for nearly 6 weeks. So I think my honest answer is that I will try it until it doesn't work anymore. And I think I'll feel less bad, but I think that guilt will still be there. And that's me being completely honest about the situation, which is that it would be a dream of mine to be able to breastfeed with no problems. That would be a dream. I would love to do that. I would absolutely love to do that. But I think the difference this time is that I will also be focused on, is it best for me too? Yeah. Because it is a symbiotic relationship between a mother and a baby. And if I'm 90 times happier bottle feeding, then that's what I'll do.
That was Letitia Gordon-Furs on Bits of Me. Don't forget to check out her podcast, New Leaf, which aims to support new mothers who are going back to work, and her brilliant Nutshell article on feeding, as well as the hashtag My Motherhood, My Choice. And please do share this episode with all your pregnancy and mammy groups. Thanks for listening.